Hello and welcome to another interview in the series Coffee with Craig. Patrick is an English teacher and a teacher trainer. He's based in Valencia, where he lives with his family. He's been training teachers for 20 years and he's helped me improve my teaching a lot. You can see the edited video version of this interview on our Mention Inglés YouTube channel. Here's the full, unedited audio interview with Patrick. We hope you enjoy it.
How long have we known each other? Because I didn't do the dip with you.
No.
How long have you been working here
In Valencia?
In Valencia.
Well, this is the fourth year that I've done stuff here.
And is that as long as you've been living here?
I did come down when I was in Madrid. I came down a few times to do some training, but I don't know, that would have been quite a long time ago now.
Mm-hmm. Was that when the British Council was in
no,
the centre?
No, they'd only just moved here though. No, were you working here then?
No, I've been here for 16 years.
Okay.
Part of the furniture.
Right.
So you came here from Madrid, so how many years in total have you been in Spain?
14? Yeah. 14 in August.
About the same.
Yeah.
And why was the decision to come here? Why did you decide to come to Spain?
It's a job. Because when we finished, my wife and I were in Prague, and we left Prague and went back to London to do MAs. And when we finished the MA, we needed a job. So we were looking around for a job, and there was a job advertised at Madrid Young Learners for ADOS, and my wife, she's more of a young learner person than I am, so she applied for it, she got it, so we went to Madrid.
And had you planned on staying so long originally?
Not really, though. I mean, things that, because she went as an ADOS and she was on a London contract, so at the end of her 4 years we had to decide, okay, does Ruth want to stay with the council, which would mean leaving Spain, or do we want to stay in Spain? And by that time, our son was very settled here and stuff. So we decided that we'd stay.
But why did you come to Valencia from Madrid?
Primarily to send our son to an international school. Because he went to Concertado for Primaria. Mm-hmm. And we had to decide, does he go to Instituto? Which is a bit boring. we started looking at international schools, and the international schools in Valencia are much, much cheaper than the ones in Madrid, and actually are better.
So, really?
Yeah. So that was the main reason.
And how old is your son now?
He's now 15.
He's 15. Does he know what he wants to do yet?
Well, yeah, we talk about it quite a lot. He wants to study zoology because he's obsessed with animals.
Oh.
But funnily enough, I was having a look on the internet about 2 days ago. There's now only one university in Britain which offers zoology. So it's Manchester. So, I mean, if he wants to do zoology, he'd have to go to Manchester.
He couldn't study here?
The alternative is studies here. You can do, certainly at Politecnica, you can do, I think, marine biology, which might be quite interesting. I taught someone at the Polytechnic who was doing marine biology. She was doing research into dolphins, and she was like working at the Oceanographique and stuff.
The Oceanographique is the perfect place to do that.
It sounded as if what she was doing was really interesting.
Where are you from originally? I can't place your accent.
London. North London.
Which part?
Highgate.
Highgate. I'm from Ilford.
Ah, okay. It's not far away.
And how old were you when you first started travelling? Have you always been a teacher?
No. After university, I played a lot of music at university. And after university, I joined a band in London playing sort of country and western. A bit sort of like, at the same time, the Pogues were getting going in London.
Great band.
We played with the Pogues a few times.
You played with the Pogues?
Yes. One of the guys I was in the band with was quite good friends of Shane McGowan, so we supported them.
Did you socialise with them?
No.
They were a bit extreme.
Yeah, first time I ever met them was...
Did they scare you?
We went into their dressing room and there was the biggest bottle of vodka I've ever seen in my life.
Intravenously.
Shane was like, you couldn't understand a word he said. He was out of it all the time. They were actually very nice people. They were very friendly. But no, we didn't socialise. So I played in a band for about 2 years. But the Pogues were very successful and we didn't really ever get anywhere. We released one record.
What was the name of the band?
The Mighty Lights of Paradise.
Catchy.
And in fact, actually, one of the guys in the band, he's kept going and he releases solo CDs, which have been quite, not really successful, but they're very well critically received. He's called Jeb Loy Nichols. He's quite... Yeah, I mean, he just sings. I don't know if he earns any money out of it, but he certainly has a sort of career as a singer-songwriter.
Search for him on iTunes.
Yeah, there you go.
Where did you go to university then?
Where?
In London, did you?
No. I went to Oxford University.
Went to Oxford?
So I was in a band for a while. Then after that, I sort of worked in a catering company for a while. I wrote a book, a history book, and sort of messed around. And so I didn't actually start teaching until I was about 27, I think, when I did a cert course. And
is that when the travelling started?
No, the original idea was I was going to go to Greece. I really fancied going to live in Greece. So I did the cert course in order to have something to do when I got to Greece. The place that I did the cert course, they offered me a job. It was supposed to be just for a month because they had a load of Japanese students coming in and they needed someone, a couple of extra teachers. But I ended up staying there for a year, which was quite good because it was quite a good way to sort of get the first bit of experience.
Did you learn Greek?
No, I didn't go to Greece.
Oh, okay.
I stayed in London. And then after about a year, originally I was going to go to France. I couldn't get a job in France. So I went back to London, stayed in London, and then I thought, this is stupid. The whole idea was to go abroad. And this was, 1990, and of course, Berlin Wall had just sort of come down and stuff.
Everything was opening up.
So I thought, I'll go to Eastern Europe. So I went to Budapest.
So you went to Budapest and then Prague.
And then Prague, yeah.
What's been the most difficult thing about making a life here in Spain?
I think in ways Spain's quite an easy place to... If you compare it to Eastern Europe, the great thing in Eastern Europe was no one assumed that you'd be able to speak the language. So when you went there to work, you got lots and lots of help and lots of support because no one thought you were going to be able to speak Hungarian or you were going to pick up enough Hungarian in a week to find a flat or to do any paperwork and get your residence permits. So you were looked after because you basically had to be. Whereas when you come to Spain, certainly our experience with British Council was it was just assumed that you could speak Spanish. And in fact, neither my wife nor I could speak any Spanish at all. I'd only been to Spain, I think, once for a weekend in Barcelona. But we were very much like, okay, you just got to look after yourself. That was the hardest thing, actually, is that being able to sort of settle in before you'd got any Spanish whatsoever and find a flat and do all of those sorts of things.
It's interesting because a few teachers have said that the biggest problem for them is the language, even after a few years. Mm. And then there's Valenciano, even if you can speak Castellano, so it can be a problem.
No, I mean, for us it was very, very... That was the hardest thing because, as I say, Prague and Budapest... We were an international house there, and they just completely looked after you. They provided you with a flat, they did your paperwork, you set up your bank account and everything. Whereas when we came here, it was like, look after yourself.
Patrick, what do you do with your free time? Do you still dabble in music?
No, I haven't. I listen to a lot, I do occasionally strum the guitar, but only very occasionally these days. What do we do? Play tennis. Go cycling, but not sort of like seriously. I'd sort of cycle to a bar.
Cycling with the family?
Yeah, to a bar, drink beers, cycle.
And then wobble back.
Yeah. Read a lot. I suppose, in the evenings, I suppose we watch telly. We watch. We don't really watch Spanish telly. We watch.
I don't blame you.
DVDs.
Same here.
Of sort of, you know, American series and that sort of stuff, or films or what. The only time we watch Spanish telly is football. I think. Cook, like cooking. We're all vegetarian, so we do. Yeah, so therefore you have to basically do a lot of cooking. Mm-hmm. But we all like cooking. So yeah, that sort of thing. And then just, you know, go for a walk, hang out, that sort of stuff.
Okay.
It's a very quiet life.
Okay. You've been you've been involved in teacher training for how many years?
Started really teacher training, I suppose, about 20 years ago. Cert courses. Before that, I did...
Pretty much after you started teaching.
It was, yeah. I mean, I'd only been teaching for about 3.5 years, maybe, when I was trained up as a cert trainer. I did the dip after... I'd been teaching about 2.5 years, and I did the dip. And then I was trained up as a cert trainer about 6 months after that. I hadn't been teaching that long.
Have you got a preference? Teacher training, teaching other teachers, or teaching students
language? I like both in a way. I mean,
they seem quite different.
Yeah, they are very different. What's ideal is to do a bit of a mixture of the two. I mean, teacher training can get a bit repetitive, in the same way that teaching can get repetitive, that, you know, you're teaching the same book or the same syllabus or the same, you know, things year in, year out, which is why, you know, for me, I always need to sort of teach different levels, do different types of classes, because otherwise it just becomes very repetitive. And yeah, but teaching a cert course, because basically a cert course, you know, what you do on a cert course doesn't really change from course to course. The people are different, but in terms of what you're doing, it never really changes. So there was a time when I was in Prague, when I was doing quite a lot of cert courses, and, you know, after about, you know, I think I'd do sort of 2 in 3 months, and after the second one, I really had enough of it. I didn't want to do any, and I needed a break because I was bored of doing it.
That teaching could do that to you as well. I added my diploma 17, 18 years ago when it was called something different. It was the D-Tefler in those days.
That's what I did.
Has it changed a lot over the years? Because I'm curious to see if the methodology's changed, the approach has changed.
I mean, in terms of methodology... well, I suppose it's sort of the big, you know, the whole sort of lexical revolution of, well, the early 90s, mid-90s.
That's what I remember. Michael
which was
Lewis
sort of just starting when I did. Because I did my dip in, 93? And, like, the lexical approach, I think, was published in 93. Mm-hmm. So it was the sort of new thing that, which not really many people picked up on at that stage, I don't think. So I suppose sort of in a way, methodologically, that's sort of come along. And then there's the sort of dogmy stuff with Scott Thornbury of, like, just walk into the classroom and see what happens.
In a nutshell.
In a nutshell. I mean, the big thing, I suppose, has been CLIL, but, you know, CLIL hasn't really...
What's CLIL?
Content Language Integrated Learning, which is, I mean, in Spain, it's basically the whole bilingual education projects, which have been going on in primary and secondary schools, of, you know, teaching... you know, geography in English, for example.
And that's CLIL, is it?
Yeah.
Teaching.
So content is the idea of
in
teaching
a
subject like geography, history, chemistry, or whatever, mm-hmm. but in a second language, which has come out of the sort of Canadian immersion schools, which were sort of all the rage. I mean, they still are. In fact, my niece goes to one, because my niece lives in Canada, which were all the rage in like the 1670s in Canada. And people have realised that, you know, this is the way to sort of, you know, get not native-like language levels, but good language levels.
And is this popular in other European countries, or mainly Spain?
Well, Spain has gone for it in a big way. Mm. Quite a few other countries are involved in the CLIL thing. But, I mean, in terms of what happens in language schools like this one, CLIL probably affects more what happens in primary. That a lot of the methodology there, but in terms of teaching sort of adults and teenagers, I don't think it's probably been as big a deal as it is in the state sector,
sure.
where I mean, particularly in primary, I mean, it's been a big revolution, and of course, been very hard for teachers, because teachers are having to get their English level up in order to be able
right.
to teach.
I've noticed the last 2 years an increase in secondary and primary school yeah. teachers in my first certificate classes, because yeah, they yeah. need B2 to
teach.
Keep their jobs.
Yeah, exactly. They've been put under an awful lot of pressure.
They are. Yeah. So what's the best thing about being a teacher, and what's the worst?
The best thing? For me, the best thing is the students. I like meeting the students and working with the students and you know, hopefully seeing them, you know, get better and improve and develop. Though, you know, I mean, one of the frustrations of the job is actually that once you get to, most students, once they get to about intermediate, this will be B1, the progress really does become...
Is it less obvious?
Very, very slow, because, I mean, you know, you're not going to really make much progress on 3 hours a week. I mean, that's the great thing about teaching beginners. I love teaching beginners.
You can really see
because beginners they learn. They, you know, they in a year they can go from, you know, being able to say virtually nothing to, you know, be able to have okay a basic but simple conversation, which is great.
That's refreshing.
Yeah.
What's been your most memorable moment in the classroom?
Yeah, I was trying to think about this. The first thing that would spring to mind, I can still remember doing my cert course, actually, a lesson that I had to teach on the cert course, and teaching, I had to teach so and such plus adjectives. And I remember sort of, it must have been something like the third lesson I did, so it was really sort of early days. And I can remember just thinking, I have no idea how to do this, and getting really sort of panicked about it, and then suddenly working out what I had to do, and going and teaching it, and it was like a successful lesson.
And it went well.
Yeah, and that was sort of the minute when I thought, actually, I really like doing this.
I can remember a similar experience. I can't remember the grammar point, but I got bogged down with a student question, and I was too inexperienced I didn't know the answer, and I tried to bluff and waffle my way out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And after that, I learned to just say, very good question, we'll go into it next lesson. And then I had time to go to the grammar book and read up on it. What's Hot English magazine?
Hot English.
Can you talk about that for a while?
Yeah, I can. Hot English magazine is as far as I'm aware, it's an international magazine. I've never seen it on sale anywhere. It's published by.
So it's not only online.
No, it's published by a company based in Madrid, which is called Hot English. They also have a school. Which I think mostly teaches sort of business English, sort of one-to-one sort of stuff.
And that's in Madrid as well?
Yeah. And I can't remember how I got... They advertised for writers, I think, in one of those like English language newspapers in Madrid. And it turned out that their premises were very near to where I lived, so I just sort of showed up one day. And originally they were going to publish some books... like some course books. So I did quite a lot of work on course books for them. Mm-hmm. And then the guy who's the editor just phoned me up one day and said, oh, you know, maybe you could write for the magazine. So I've written lots and lots of readings and listening texts for them.
Do you record the listening texts as well?
They do it, yeah.
They record the listening texts.
Yeah, they're quite, you know, I mean... They're quite sort of professional quality. They do it, you know, a real studio and stuff.
And is it a subscription-based website that you pay per month? Or,
to be honest, I've no idea.
Okay.
I wonder, actually, how well they're surviving at the moment, because I think they've been having a bit of trouble, what with the recession and stuff. But the magazine is actually quite good. It's got some quite, you know, it's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's got quite.
So it's a useful resource for.
Yeah, definitely.
Is there support for Spanish learners?
Yeah.
Good.
Though, I mean, it's not specifically aimed at just Spain. But yeah. No, it's good. It's worth having a look at.
Okay. And you recently spoke in Seville at the Macmillan Teachers' Day.
Yeah.
Do you get many gigs like that? Do you enjoy them? Traveling and speaking?
I don't mind the speaking. I don't like the traveling is a bit of a drag because.
Takes you away from the family.
Yeah, but also it's just that, you know, it's very time-consuming. I mean, to get to Seville, I went on the Ave, and it took, I don't know, 5 hours or something to get there. And you know, then you stay in a hotel, they put you in a nice hotel and they take you out for dinner, which is all quite nice. But and then the next day, on the Saturday, you do your talk, and then you've got to come all the way back. And it's just, you know, you're away for about a day and a half to do a 1 hour, 15 minute talk, which is, I mean, it's okay. You don't, you know, the thing is, you don't get to see the places. I mean, like,
you don't have time to.
No, last year I went to A Coruña, and there was a problem with the flights. It took me 15 hours to get to A Coruña. You know, I got there at 11 o'clock at night, went to bed, got up, did my talk, and then had to go straight back to the airport. So, you know, I've been to A Coruña, but I haven't seen anything.
And are most of these talks in Spain, or do you travel abroad?
No, I've never done anything abroad, because the books that I write are just aimed at the Spanish market.
And the books that you've written, are they... I saw one called Motivate, it's aimed at teenagers. What sort of ages do you tend to write for?
Teenagers, yeah, Motivate.
Great title.
Yeah, well, Motivate was nothing to do with me. I actually only discovered that Motivate existed about 2 weeks ago, when I was trying to find some information about something else, and this thing came out on Google, and I thought, what
is this? I Googled you, that was one of the main hits on the first page, so I naturally assumed that's your best-selling book.
I got in touch with Macmillan and said, can you tell me what Motivate is, because I've no idea what it is. And it's... what it is, it's a version of another book that I wrote, which is being aimed at the international market. And I think specifically they said Poland. And they'd just forgotten to tell me that they were going to do it.
So it's your material, but it'd been retitled, renamed for another market.
Yeah. And because I then found out that there's even another version of it, which is being released in Argentina under another name.
Strange they don't tell you these things.
Yeah, I know. Well, they should, yeah.
So most of the books you've written, have they been aimed at that age group, sort of teenagers?
Most of the stuff that I've done has been aimed at the teenage market. I did, with my wife, I wrote part of a primary course quite a long time ago, but that's not really sort of my area. So yeah, no, it's nearly all for teenagers.
What advice would you give Spanish speakers who are trying to learn English?
I'd say, well, go to a course, have lessons, definitely. Teaching helps, but it's not the only thing that helps. I mean, you need to be prepared to do a lot of work outside of the classroom. Things like, you know, watch films, watch, you know, maybe films, maybe it was too long to start with, but, you know, watch... It's like, you know, 15-minute comedy programs or 20-minute
YouTube videos, perhaps.
YouTube, yeah. Things where you can get subtitles to help you to start with.
Subtitles in English.
In English, yeah. Watch with the subtitles. Read. Find, you know, maybe sort of something short little newspaper article or something on the internet.
Do you have a favourite online resource that you direct your students to?
To be honest, I don't really use online that much, apart from YouTube, really. So, yeah, I tend to sort of say, you know, go and find something about this, or I'll find something and say, OK, everyone go home, watch this, we'll talk about it in the next lesson, sort of thing. In terms of sort of actual specific English language teaching resources, I don't know, I don't really use them probably as much as I should.
On the subject of the internet, how has technology affected the way you teach, and how has it affected the way your students learn, or perhaps your teachers?
I suspect it hasn't affected the way I teach very much, to be honest. The thing is that I sort of tend to think that because teaching is still so much based around course books. And that for all the sort of...
Do you think that's as true now as it was when we started sort of 16, 20 years ago, whatever?
I think it is, really. I mean, despite the fact that there's now a vast amount of authentic material available, certainly from the teachers that I work with, either in a centre like this or... I mean, I used to do a lot of work with Spanish state school teachers... they are, you know, I would say everyone is basically still following a course book. And as I said, while there's all these sort of technological add-ons that you can have now, I'm not sure that they've yet had a major effect on how people teach. I mean, the fact that you can now have the book on a screen,
right, and click for the audio.
Yeah, but in a way, it doesn't
really change the methodology
necessarily how you exploit the material. In a way, maybe it has an adverse effect because it becomes sort of too easy to sort of show off with the technology,
right?
And instead of thinking about actually am I using this in the most sensible way.
That's true. One thing I've noticed working here is that where we used to have a computer slot where the students would come out of the class for 20 minutes or half an hour and do a computer gap fill program on the computer or some sort of grammar exercise, they can find that at home online now, which really puts some responsibility onto them and gives them more sort of teacher time in the classroom.
Yeah. No, I mean, I have written quite a lot of online tasks, sort of work for, in fact, most of it for primary. And there's lots of, the publishers have on their websites lots of good stuff which kids can do at home and stuff. I think for me, the main way in which I've used technology actually is for writing skills, is that I tend to do writing lessons in computer rooms because I find that students enjoy writing much, much more if they're writing on a computer than writing on a piece of paper because they can edit it and they can put pictures on and then the whole experience becomes much more interesting.
How does that work? Do you use a blog? Do you use some sort of wiki?
No, more just, like word
processing. Just on Word?
Yeah. If you want them to write some sort of text, just locate them so they can use the spell check and they use the grammar check and all the things which, are there to help.
And we do naturally anyway,
yeah,
in our language.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about what you hope to do in the future?
I think what I would like to do is write a book that I would like to write, in a way. It's sort of something which is more, would perhaps be a bit more sort of revolutionary, something a bit different, with more sort of up-to-date methodology and content, and something which is aimed more at really genuinely developing particularly student speaking and listening skills. But I mean, how feasible it is to do that because the market is very conservative. I wouldn't mind writing another book, but writing something which is more what I would like to write, rather than, at the moment, authors tend to have to write what they're told to write
by the publisher.
Yeah, and so therefore you produce something with lots of quite boring grammar exercises because that's what the publisher wants, because that's what the publishers think the teachers want.
Do you do any creative writing?
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah.
Would you consider publishing any of that?
Yeah, if I could. No, I've written a few. I've written two novels.
But at the moment they're unpublished.
Yeah.
It's much easier to self-publish novels than the kind of writing that you have published because of the format.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Gets complicated with pictures and gap fills and whatnot. Yeah. Patrick, what makes you happy?
What makes me happy? Spending time with my family, to be honest, actually. That's what I most enjoy doing. And unfortunately, my son's 15, but he still likes being with us.
And we enjoy it while he's there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the sad thing is that, of course,
another couple of years.
In 3 years, he won't be here anymore. Because
yeah, with his girlfriend.
If he's going to go to, he wants to go to university in Britain. So there's a good chance that in 3 years, he'll have left. And, that'll be it.
Right.
So, yeah, no, that's what we tend to do. I mean, these days he spends an awful lot of time out with his friends as well, but he's always happy to do stuff with us. So, that's the main thing, I think.
What makes you sad?
I don't know, I'm not a very sad person, I think. I sometimes get, professionally frustrated about, in a way, going back to the books, about, writing something which you think...
Yeah, that your heart's not in.
Yeah, and that you sort of think, I wouldn't... It's a bit daft when you're writing material, you think, I wouldn't use this. because, or I wouldn't do with this what they're asking me to write. You know, I wouldn't exploit it in this way because they're actually more interesting and more methodologically sound ways to exploit it, but I'm not allowed to.
I totally sympathise. There's some things that I have to do because that's the thing that brings in the money at the end of the month, and things like these interviews that I really enjoy doing, but obviously they're not
going to
put food on the table, so you need a balance. Yeah. Which famous person, dead or alive, would you like to have dinner with?
Let's think. Maybe Alexander the Great.
Why?
I studied Alexander the Great at university, and it was the bit of my course that I most enjoyed. It was called a special subject, and so it was the sort of subject you did in the greatest depth. He's just a very interesting guy.
What would you ask him?
Well,
no, the big, I'm really putting you on the spot.
The big question, if you're an Alexander fan, is because he invaded the Middle East, and basically, you know, his army got as far as India, and the question has always been, why did he turn back? Because he got to India and then he turned back anyway, came back and went through what would now be Saudi Arabia and into Egypt, which is where he died. And the question has always been, why did he stop? Why didn't he just keep going? So that's what I'd ask him.
Okay. What's your idea of a perfect day?
Perfect day. Bit of a lie-in, probably. Nice weather, sunny weather like we have here. Lunch with like family, friends. Maybe sort of, you know, nice food like. I like sort of like Middle Eastern food, Lebanese food, Greek food, that sort of stuff. Some wine and, you know, sort of lazy afternoon. Maybe go for a walk. Evening, I don't know. Watch telly, watch a film or something like that. Read a book. Yeah, nothing very exciting.
If you could change something about yourself, what would you change?
I wish I was a bit more maybe entrepreneurial. I'm one of these people who I constantly have sort of ideas about things to do and stuff.
I hope you write them down.
I'm not very good at actually doing anything about them. I mean, yeah, so, I mean, I've written, as I say, sort of two novels, but never really sort of exploited them enough. I'm a bit lazy, really.
That touches on something that I'm interested to ask you, because you obviously work a lot at home.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for me personally on how to discipline yourself to get up and do that work at the computer, rather than procrastinate and not sit down and especially the work that you mentioned before, that you find it a bit of a tough thing to an ordeal to do because it's not particularly creative or motivating.
Well, I mean, the thing is, of course, you have deadlines.
That helps you, doesn't it, the deadline?
Yeah, and also because the deadlines tend to be ridiculously short, because, again, this is something you don't really realise until you start getting involved in it. The whole sort of publishing process, particularly nowadays with all the technological add-ons, creating a course is immensely complicated. This is why courses are not really written by just one person anymore, because my wife publishes primary books, and each course will have six levels, and each level has 14 components. So just to produce, you know, Primera de la Primaria, there are 14 things that have to be put together.
So did she work with co-writers?
Yeah, she's not a writer anymore. She's now she's the commissioning editor. So, you know, there's someone writing the student's book, there may be someone completely different writing the workbook, someone else writing the teacher's book, and someone's writing the DVD scripts, and someone else is writing the songs, and someone else is the... I mean, it's...
complicated.
It's incredibly complicated.
So you tend
to therefore they set in order to coordinate all of this thing, in order to get the thing published on time, the deadlines that they set are very, very tight. So therefore, you know, you really can't prevaricate, because you know if you miss the deadline, they'll never use you again. So therefore you sit down and you do it.
Yeah. If you had €6,000 to spend on yourself, what would you buy?
€6,000 just to spend on me.
Not your family, just you.
Well, having said that, I hardly ever play the guitar, which is true. I've always, there's one particular guitar I've always really wanted to have, which is a Gretsch guitar, which is American guitars. They're still made, I think, but they were very popular in the 60s.
By acoustic or electric?
Semi-acoustic. And they're just like beautiful guitars, and they're fantastic.
Would that be enough for a Gretsch?
Yeah, you'd probably get a Gretsch for a couple of thousand, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe buy
an amplifier.
Nice amplifier. Yeah, probably something like that. That's always, you know, whenever someone says, you know, what would you like for your birthday? I always say,
a Gretsch, please.
Red Gretsch, then, because I haven't got one. But well, yeah, maybe something like that.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed that interview with Patrick, and thank you very much for listening. Please help us by writing a comment on iTunes for us so that more people can find our podcasts. And you can also write a comment or a question about this interview on our Facebook page at facebook.com/mencionengles, or tweet me on Twitter at Mencion Twit. Bye for now.